very happy to be here, and it's wonderful to see everyone. And I'd like to dedicate this talk to Shinryu Suzuki Roshi and Dear Kobun Chino, and my teacher Zenkei Blanche Hartman, and of course to you for inviting me. Thank you very much to all of you for inviting me here. This part is always kind of exciting. I very rarely have any idea of what's actually going to come out as a talk, and I want to encourage everybody to feel free to ask questions if you want to at any point. It's absolutely fine to do that. So, my teacher, Zenkei Blanche Hartman, was the second woman in our lineage. As you probably know, in years gone by, it was mainly men that practiced, especially to be monks, to be Zen monks. It was mainly men. So Blanche was a real innovator. And she was the first woman to be abbot of a monastery, of a Zen center. And she's still there, and I want to encourage everyone to go and visit her. She's quite wonderful. So I lived at the Zen center for about 15 or 16 years, and I actually met Kobun Chino when I was living at Tassajara. And when I looked at this altar out here, I saw so many dear friends that have departed. Of course, Lou, who's on the altar, is Blanche's husband, and he passed about 3 years ago. So I actually left formal training in... I have a terrible memory. 2000 and something, about 7 or 8 years ago. Because I had started to work in SRO hotels, single resident occupancy hotels, and in shelters with homeless folks, and in hospice, and just different places out there, taking our practice out there onto the streets in San Francisco. Yeah. I don't dress like this when I'm at work. This is actually the robe I wear to do memorials in the SRO hotels. I do 3 or 4 of those a week. But usually I'm actually wearing a pair of jeans and a hoodie or something like that. Yeah. So I found that this practice that we have is amazingly useful to so many people. An awful lot of people don't feel very drawn to coming into, you know, somewhere where you're wearing black robes and you're sitting that far away from the wall staring at it. I mean, it's not always the most inviting prospect for people, you know. And we do tend to get a bit serious looking, you know. They used to say...
Some of us.
They used to tell me when I first started that the first arising on the path of practice was joy. And I thought, oh, you know, they don't look very joyful. But of course, when you're first learning to train your mind, which is how I tend to present it out in the public arena, of course, a lot of things come up that you were stuffing behind you for a long time. So of course the first bit of practice can often bring things up that are kind of painful. But, you know, keep going, and after that, as you know, it's all golden and rainbows. Nothing bothers you anymore.
You're right.
In actual fact, I found myself falling into that trap. A couple of years ago, my health started to kind of go downhill. I'm just getting old and burnt out, really. And I ended up in hospital. And I suffered from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And of course, Zazen, our practice, wonderful for that. But I got all upset being stuck in a hospital again. I got quite triggered. And I just wanted to run away and shout and do all these wild things. And I found myself thinking, oh, now, I've been practicing for 20 years, and before that I had a Tibetan teacher. I should not be getting upset. So that's one of the first things when I'm sharing our practice with people, is to say that we're not trying to perfect ourselves. And you're just, as Suzuki Roshi said, you're just perfect just the way you are. We could all use a little improvement, he said after that. But the way you are right now, exactly with all our little funny bits, that's just the way it is. That's our own perfection. So I'm always careful to tell people when I'm showing them how to do a practice, don't think that you are going to perfect yourself. This is about seeing what's sitting right here and just accepting it. There's not a better version of you out there somewhere, and if only you practiced hard enough, you would get to that better version, you know. So our practice is enormously useful, even to folks who wouldn't want to, you know, come and get dressed in black and shave their hair and so forth. Recently I've been asked to take Zazen, although I call it different things, of course, to take Zazen into all the hotels in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. So I'm busy training the staff and all the residents so that everybody can just find that little bit of peace, if there's a bit of peace there, of course. So it's very interesting. For example, a few weeks ago they put me in a room with 15 maintenance workers. The janitors all sitting there in their blue overalls, you know, okay. So what, you know, what? And a lot of people think I'm a guy, especially when my hair's shorter. I get sore all the time. So they didn't know who I was. They heard I was a priest. There's this strange-looking person sitting there. I've got 15 minutes to pass on our practice to them without talking about religion, in a way that's directly functional and useful. The Tenderloin Housing Clinic, which has 16 hotels in San Francisco, is introducing something called pause, which always makes me think of, you know, pause. Pause at 3 o'clock and take 3 minutes and just...
Do they ring a bell or something?
Well, it's interesting. Case managers all have cell phones. So at 3 o'clock, if you're sitting with the case manager, their cell phone will ring. And before I got there, they were training them all to go, you know, close their eyes and of course they're going. So now what they're going to do is, you know, they just put down whatever they're working with and just take a few moments. I've actually passed on the Tibetan practice of tsumpa, three breaths.
With the bell?
Yeah. So the bell, the phone rings and that's their bell. And then they begin. So it's kind of interesting. But it's also interesting what picture people have of meditation. You know, they often, if you say we're going to meditate, they think, oh, we're going to sit and imagine we're on a beach somewhere. You know, and I'm imagining that I'm seeing the sunshine and I'm imagining I'm going to, you know. So the very first thing is to tell people, no, it's about staying right here. And a lot of my work is with people who have addictions, mental health issues, lots and lots of interesting things to work with. So the first thing is just being right here with whatever that might be, you know. And of course the acceptance part is very important. So the only time I ever laughed at my teacher in public was when she... read this poem that I brought with me today. And the reason I laughed, and of course I was embarrassed and bowed, but she was trying to do a Scottish accent. And I can't do an American accent. It just, you know, it really, I can't get my mouth around it somehow, you know. And certainly most people who attempt a Scottish accent, whether they know it or not, are actually, they sound Irish. You know, and I have had people say "top of the morning" to me. What? But because I'm really interested in the everydayness of our practice, I like to use things that are familiar. So I often use poetry, And I particularly enjoy using Scottish poetry because, as you know, you cannot get at the Dharma through the intellect. Doesn't matter how many books you've studied or how many sutras you can recite, that which can be named, as it says in the sutras, just to depict it in literary form is to relegate it to defilement. Because once you start to say, I've got, oh, I know it, I've got it, you've only got one side of it, you know. Suzuki Roshi used to say, if you're listening to me talking, you're only hearing half of what I'm saying. He said, if I say this, I also mean that. Now, this is kind of confusing to the Western mind, you know, because we get so fixed on, I think especially in America, I always say, well, if everybody here can be president, what terribly high expectations everybody must have of themselves, you know. I'd never expected to be president of anything growing up, you know. In fact, as you know, Scotland is not recognised as a nation, so I've never actually voted at all. So some of the ancient teaching methods, I'm very fond of them, and I don't know, has anyone heard of the Avatamsaka Sutra? Or it's called the Flower Ornament Sutra. Has anyone heard of that? Yes, only my students, yes. Oh, I should have said there's three of my students who very kindly brought me up today. And Kent at the back, and Misaki here, and Paul over here. So they were, I don't drive, they were kind enough to drive me up. Well, basically the Avatamsaka Sutra, or Flower Ornament Sutra, gives you the teachings, but not in the way you would really particularly recognize. It uses repetition, so your mind starts to try and follow it. I did this every year at Tassajara in the summer with the young folks that came. And it warns at the beginning, Thomas Cleary is the translator, and he says, beware of the bliss. And of course, as I said, joy is the first arising. So that sounded encouraging to me. And what it does is, because of the repetition, the mind starts to try and follow it. And eventually it gets to the point after a few minutes of going, ah, I can't follow that. And it's the most wonderful experience because it gives up. And that's how the teaching works. Once the mind gives up, then the teaching comes directly in. Because while we are judging things, while we have, you know, our mind, so to speak, but there's another good talk, while we're doing that, we're separating ourselves from everything. You know, I often give that example for when we're sitting zazen. If I'm sitting zazen and the thought glasses comes to mind, that's quite peaceful, you know. But that's usually not where we leave it, you know, it's glasses. Oh, they don't look so good. Oh, you know, I'm so silly, I should have brought my new glasses. I would have made a much better impression if I had my new glasses. That's off into thinking, you know. So how do we get ourselves to just stay right here and just keep coming back right here and keep coming back right here? Well, this was the poem that that Blanche read. And I was her, what do you call that position? I've forgotten some of the ceremonial thing. The Jisho, with the incense.
She wrote the poem?
This is by a very famous person. Robert Burns, Rabbi Burns. Oh, wait a minute, does that mean you're going to understand what I'm saying? I must admit that my mother, I'm from a very poor working class background, and in Scotland in the 50s you could be pigeonholed and kept in your place by your accent. So my mum and dad saved up money and sent me for speech lessons. And that's the only reason that you can understand me. Otherwise, so as you see, otherwise you would not have been able to understand me. So Rabbi Burns, Robert Burns, wrote a poem called Te Amuse to a Mouse. And I actually do stand-up performances once a year of his poetry and songs, and I do a comedy monologue with it too. But I won't do that right now, so. Unless you really want me to. I tell jokes at memorials too. I think it's very important to the joy of things. You know, life is way too short to waste it worrying about things. Anyway, so what I do when I'm performing, and it is in a bar, is that I say a bit in my old Scottish accent, and then I translate it into English. So, to me, this has rather the same effect as the ancient Indian Avatamsaka Sutra, because you might not understand what you're hearing at first, but when I throw in the little bits of English, I think you'll get the point, especially at the end. Oh, was that a poor bird?
Yes.
Oh.
Hmm? Came to
hear the
poem.
Came to
the bird wanted to hear the poem.
Oh. So, this poem is to a mouse, and it's called To a Mouse on Turning Her Up in Her Nest with the Plough, November 1785. Rabbi Burns was actually a ploughman, and very, very poor, until the English folk started to enjoy his poetry, and he actually started to collect Scottish poetry, because most of our culture, as you may know, was kind of thrown away by the English. That's why I'm speaking a foreign language. My grandfather was the last one that spoke Gaelic, which was our native language. So, anywho's, I won't go on and on. I'll just start to read. So, I'll wait till... I don't want you to miss anything.
Okay.
The bird's all right? Like, there was one hit that window when we were sitting Zazen earlier. You know, at Zen Center, I can draw. I made little cut-out blackbirds if we stuck them on any windows so the birds could see the windows. Anyway, so here we are. He was a ploughman. He died very young. He became popular with the rich English folks, and then fell out of favour because he wrote poems that said things like, man to man the world over shall brothers be. In other words, he was a socialist. And it wasn't popular at that time. So he actually ended up dying in poverty. Tamus. Wee sleekit cur and timorous beastie, ah, what a panic's in thy breastie. They need to start away so hasty wi' bicker and brattle. I would be laith to run and chase you wi' murder and prattle. And that's the meaning of life. We do that one. I don't have meetings in a zendo. We meet outdoors mostly, in a community garden. And that's the joke, that's our running joke. When I'm talking and a big truck goes by right behind us on the street, and I keep moving my mouth, and I always say, and that was the meaning of life when the truck goes by. Anyway. So, a wee sleekit cur and timorous, so small, cowering little beast, and that was where I think I lost it, when Blanche said, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie, and I just burst out laughing. It's a panic in thy breastie. Anyway, he's saying to the mouse, don't panic, I'm sorry, I'm ploughing through your nest. That's the opening part. I'll do a wee bit more English so you can probably understand it. I'm truly sorry. Man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal. My mother used to always say, use your lips to try and get the English right. I doubt nae whiles but thou may thieve. What then, poor beastie, thou mun live, a daemon icker and a thrave's a small request. I'll get a blessing with the lave and ne'er missed. So he's saying, I know that you steal. It's all right, it's just a little bit. And I'm blessed, you know, because I'll never miss it. You're hungry. And then he's apologising again. He's run the plough through the mouse's nest. He goes, Thy wee bit who see to in ruin, it silly was the winds are strewing. And Nathan now to big a new ain of foggage green, and bleak December's winds ensuing, both Snell and Keen. Your house is all in pieces, there's nothing to build a new one with, and December's winds are blowing through. Oh good, everybody's still paying attention. Thou saw the fields laid bare and waste, and weary winter coming fast, and cosy here beneath the blast thou thought to dwell, till crash the cruel coulter, that's the plough, passed out through thy cell. That wee bit heap of leaves and stibble has cost thee money a weary nibble. I can see people are beginning to understand the language. Now thou's turned out for all thy trouble, but house or hold, to thaw the winter's sleety dribble and Cranruach cold. No house to keep out the rain and the cold. Now, here's the big bit, and this is the part that everybody's going to recognise and realise that you already know this poem. Okay? That was in English, that part of it. But Moosey, thou art no thy lane, in proving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes o' mice and men gang after glay, and leest not but grief and pain for promised joy. So that's the lines, I'm sure everybody knows that. The best laid schemes of mice and men gang after glay. So whatever we plan out for the future, it often gets messed up. Still, thou art blessed compared with me. The present only toucheth thee. But I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward, though I canna see, I guess and fear. You didn't know that was all about that, did you? So he's saying basically that, you know, the mouse is, you know, there's painful things happening and it's lost its house and its food and all the rest of it. But he's saying the mouse is blessed compared to him and basically to human beings. Because we, as he says, a backward cast my ee, I'm always looking at the past. I can't even say this is a nice cool glass of water unless I actually am referencing something that I already know from the past. So most of our suffering comes from the past. I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I hadn't done that. If only I hadn't spent my whole life doing such and such, I'd be a better person, you know. Or the future. A forward, though I canna see, I guess, and fear. Basically, we don't know what's going to happen in the future at all. We like to think we've got an idea. I mean, I thought I was going to go on and on forever on the streets, fall over dead sometime when I was about 80, and that was it. But actually, I have to stop. So, what happens in the future? That's the other part where stress happens for us. Always trying to figure out what's going to come next, what's going to happen next. But if you're listening to my voice, is everybody listening to my voice right now? So raise your hand if you're suffering from something that's happening right in this moment. Now it's got to be, the cause has got to be right this moment.
25 different things of suffering.
Well, what the?
Legs.
No, wait, that's pain. That's not suffering, that's pain. Yeah, suffering.
Yeah, lack of comprehension, but that's me blaming myself for not completely understanding the accent. And
oh, is my accent troublesome?
I think we'd rather hear the other English.
What, we easily get cool and timid as beastie on that one?
The one grew up with.
Well, in other words, there's not really any suffering. For all you know, I'm not making any sense at all. I have no idea. It just says, that's what I said, it just kind of comes out there. So, congratulations, everybody, on your enlightenment. And that's actually what I did with the 15 maintenance men. Because you can't walk in and sit down and talk about how great it is for 15 minutes or how that will relieve your suffering for, you know, blah, 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 blah. That doesn't mean a thing. But if everybody like you all just did realizes that right here, right now, in this moment, there's no cause for suffering, they've already got it. They've got it before I even start trying to explain it. And that is to... one way of looking at things, that is the complete relief of suffering. If I can just stay right here. Now, I'm not talking about ignore your thoughts. I thought for the first couple of years of practice it meant stop your thinking. But as Uchiyama Roshi says, the mind produces thoughts like the body produces sweat. It's just what it does, you know. So why pay all that attention to it? Unless you're working on something, of course. So it seems like there's the advice for today. Be more like a mouse. practice. I just want to encourage everybody to practice. It's a joy when you see people doing it, especially people that, you know, are not used to it, haven't come around before. I'd like to tell one story from... I work in the women's shelter. And most people there... I work in the recovery program. So most people are coming off some kind of drug or alcohol. The most dangerous drug, alcohol. And so they're in quite a state. And you wouldn't think that folks whose life is so troubled would actually, you know, people, someone said to me actually from the Zen Center, those people can't do Zazen. You know, those people can't do that at all. How could they do it? You know, it's too much for them. It's too much for the brain. And what a load of rubbish. Everybody, I've never met anybody yet that couldn't practice Zazen. But as I say, I don't call it Zazen. We call it just sitting. Blanche says it's not just sitting, it's just sitting doing nothing else, which I really like. So that's what I train the ladies to do, as I call them. And we sit out in the community garden and, you know, I counsel and then something will come up and there's a good starting place for the Zazen, so we usually find something to work on right away. One of my happy, happy stories is a lady who had never practiced Zazen before and was sitting and practicing with me and doing counseling with me. And she had to go to, I was going to say 850 Bryant, that's so well known in San Francisco. She had to go to the police station, to get a felony expunged so she could get some decent housing. And she went into the police station, and she'd been in jail before, and she started to get really irritated at, you know, the way the police were talking to her. And she said she just started to feel like she just wanted to turn around and punch the guy because he was just being so horrible. But she knew if she did that, she'd never get her good housing. She'd be back in jail. So she said she was just feeling full of fury. And she suddenly remembered what we did in the group. And she said she remembered that we practiced watching emotions come up, because after all, it's just another bunch of thoughts. Watching emotions come up, but knowing that if she stayed still, they would go away again. And so that's what she did. She watched the anger and the desire to hit the cop, and then she watched it go down again. And then she said, thank you, officer, and signed the paper and got her housing. So that's part of my big inspiration for being out there on the streets, is that these skill sets are useful to everyone. And I don't believe that the Buddha just, you know, taught, you know, people who were well off. Many of the stories, of course, the old stories, you know, Buddha's out there with people. And, so I really encourage everybody, if you find any of this that's useful to you, pass it on. I think we really need this in America. We really need to spread this in America. so that people can come back to this, the basic joy of being here. Just to be alive is enough, is what Suzuki Roshi always said. Just to be alive is enough. Did I bring any more Scottish poems? No. Oh, well, here's something that jumped in. I brought two pieces of paper. I was saying that my teacher doesn't like it when I teach spontaneously, so I usually, if she's there, I usually bring a whole bunch of papers and put it there, and then every now and then I'll kind of pick it up and, you know. But down here, I find if I plan it, I mean, when I first started to give talks, of course, I wrote the whole thing, because after all, it's the Dharma, and I was terrified that I would say something wrong and lead people up the garden path and, you know, just give them the wrong idea. So the first time I remember doing it, and I was sitting there reading it, and everybody's kind of sitting there patiently, you know, and I thought, I didn't feel like I was really connecting. And I thought, well, if this practice is about anything, it's just about being ourselves just as we are, just the way we are, nothing added, nothing taken away. So I did write the next talk, but then I sat on it, just in case I might panic in the middle and, you know. But if this is about anything, our practice, it's of course loving kindness and it's connection. Connection to each other and to, you know, the real self. Real non-existent self. And we won't go there. Anyway, here is perhaps a thought to leave you with. And I'd love it then if people had questions or anything like that. Rumi is one of my other favourite poets. If anyone enjoys love poetry that he writes, and he writes to God or the Spirit. You can't tell if he's writing to a lover or to the Holy Spirit. And this poem somehow just got into my bag, so I'll just read this for the ending. Oh, I know the way you can get if you've not been drinking love. You might rip apart every sentence your friends and teachers say, looking for hidden clauses. You might weigh every word on a scale like a dead fish. You might pull out a ruler to measure from every angle in your darkness the beautiful dimensions of a heart you once trusted. I know the way you can get if you have not had a drink from love's hands. That's why I say, bring your cup near me, for all I care about is quenching your thirst for freedom. All a sane person can ever care about is giving love. So thank you so much. Does anyone have any questions or words of wisdom or Scottish poetry?
Thank you, Jenna. What brought you to Buddhist practice? When did you first start? What was your that moment?
Well, I actually became interested in my 20s. And a friend of mine used to always seem to be so serene, you know, right in the middle of wild Scottish parties, she'd be sitting there, you know. And I asked her what she did, and she said she practiced Zen. And so I looked into it, I looked into Buddhism in general. But it seemed so damn miserable. It was suffering, 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 suffering. And I didn't get that it was the end of suffering. And I thought, why would I want to read about this? It's suffering, suffering, suffering. So I gave up on that. I thought of myself as a Taoist after that. But anyway.
So you were in Scotland?
Yes. And then actually when I came to America, I'd been here for about a year and was in a very abusive relationship, ended up with severe PTSD and lost the ability to go out to work and became homeless. So I was terribly, terribly ashamed because I was the first one in my family to go to college and have the nice accent and everything. And I ended up thinking I was going to be another dead homeless person lying on the streets of San Francisco. And as Blanche always said, no one comes to practice because they're wildly happy. Right? So I bet a lot of people came to practice not because, whoa, hey, hey, but because there was something you thought, maybe I could do something with this, you know. So I was terribly miserable, drinking a lot, and I didn't dare to tell them when I went to the Zen Center that I was homeless. So I got in there and they didn't know. And that was how I got started. And it, the simplicity of the practice and the fact that, I mean, every drink, every drug, anything you do, chocolate donuts, too much television, continuous bad relationships, it's all about getting away from here because we don't think we can deal with this. And in actual fact, whatever we're doing, we're not going anywhere, you know. So I found that, so as soon as I found out how wonderful it was, even though at first it was painful, I started going out then and doing the homeless memorials and stuff like that. So no one could be more surprised than me than when Blanche gave me Jukai and then ordained me, and I couldn't believe it. And then when this happened, I actually had already left Zen Center when my teacher decided that I should have Dharma transmission. And I still can't quite believe that, and that was a few years ago. But I'm very happy to have a Sangha. I do have formal students in the city as well as working with lots of other people. It's called the Zenkei Sangha. And it's named after my teacher. And Zenkei means inconceivable joy. So I'm actually up here because I'm interested in the idea of being up here, living up here. My teacher was sad when she heard me say that. But then I've already got, you know, supposing I did end up here, I've already got 2 rides to the city a month. So. But, yes, it was absolute misery. Sheer, unadulterated misery was why I came to practice. Yes?
How do I know the difference between what happened in past or future from what's happening now? How do I know? Just wondering.
How do you know that you're here and not in the past or the future?
How do I distinct between what's happening now and what was past or what's going to happen in the future? Because in your everyday busy thought, those things tend to get jangled up and it's hard to pin down what is happening now. Sometimes we have any...
Well, that's why we sometimes use those words, you know, to kind of cut through. Well, because our awareness, the fact that we sit, already gives us an awareness of what is going on. But if there's a lot of stuff going on and it seems like, aha, no, I don't know what I'm doing, we can use a word to cut through. Like we use one sometimes in the Sangha. It comes from Batman and Robin. You know the Batman and Robin on TV, the old one from the 70s? And, you know, it's usually Batman and Robin's here and the criminals are here and the narrator keeps going, meanwhile, Batman and Robin are in the... And then, meanwhile, over here, meanwhile. So we've found that word, meanwhile, that's a good one. If you're sitting, try meanwhile. And then,
what's happening right here?
Meanwhile, back at the plot, yeah. Meanwhile.
Meanwhile, back at the present moment?
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, Zen, as it progresses in America, is going to take up some very interesting forms. I remember when someone came to Zen Center from Holland and started to complain. They said, where's the American statues? Why is it all, you know, like Indian and Chinese and Japanese? And I looked at him and I said, okay, well, if we were going to have an American Buddha on the altar, what would it look like? Who would it be? John Wayne, maybe? No, he was Scottish. It's an interesting question. So until we... I mean, it could be any one of us, because, of course, we're all Buddha. But that's an interesting question. What's an American Buddha look like?
Having Western features, huh? Something.
Maybe dressed in different clothes.
Business suits.
Yeah. So I think we need to work on that one. What is an American Buddha? But it will be interesting. I'm very glad that I was often very happy when they kept the chants the same for very long times at Zen Center, because they didn't want to throw things away just because we might not understand. You know, even though we've got translations, we still don't know.
From the Japanese.
Exactly, yeah, from the Japanese. Did someone ask if they had up? Yeah.
Say good morning, and just really enjoyed your talk, and I really like that you brought love into the conversation, because sometimes I feel like, you know, like I said, it's kind of serious, and, you know, I like the way that you always talked, you also talked about the perfection of how we are right now, and that concept of loving ourselves just as we are, like, okay,
yeah.
I have a strong feeling, and I'm angry, and pissed off, and I hate this, and I hate that, but that's what's happening
yes.
right now, you know,
yeah.
So, I just love that, and I also love that that you're in the world, you know. I've dabbled in different communities, and, you know, people are like, come, live up here on the land, get, you know, go into retreat, and I always felt like my place was to be, you know, in with the people, you know, like, I can't really get away from it, so it's that challenge of balancing, you know, a contemplative life and practice with being super in the world too.
Yeah.
So wow, I'm so excited to meet you and hear about what you do.
Oh well, thank you.
This is awesome. And in the Metta Sutra, they talk about infusing love all over the world. Is that
yes.
mind in
oh, above, below, and all around without limit. Yeah.
I love Hafiz. He's my other favorite.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Oh. Well, given the kind of whale sounds that were going around the Zendo earlier, people's stomachs calling to each other. I'll just say one other thing. It's a lot of us have a lot of trouble caring for ourselves, and I never did until I found practice, really. And it's one of my main points when I'm teaching. And I have a group on a Friday. It's Golden Gate for seniors. They're all in recovery. They're living in a recovery house. And the last thing you want is to sit there looking serious. I mean, Blanche sometimes says I'm too kind of entertaining, but you can't go in and they're all having a hard time and then be like, well, I'm going to show you something. So a couple of weeks ago, we decided, or it just came up, I said something about the main point of this is love. And then we decided during our zazen, instead of, you know, just sitting looking at the floor, we would all think of songs that had the word love in the title. And then I hit the bell, and we didn't stop the zazen, but I hit the bell to give everybody permission to sing a bit of the love song or just say the titles. So that for half an hour, everybody's mind was looking around for something with love in it. Or I taught a bunch of folks in the Tenderloin, and they looked a bit sad. So I said, for the next half hour, I want everybody to try and think of their favourite joke. And if you get inspired with a real good one, just put your hand up and we'll have that.